Welcome to the E-Trade Financial third quarter 2011 earnings conference call. At this time, all participants have been placed in a listen-only mode. Following the formal remarks, we will open the call for Q&A. At that time, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Thank you. It is now my pleasure to turn the floor over to Susan Hickey from E-Trade Financial. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for E-Trade Financial's third quarter 2011 conference call. Joining today are Stephen Freiberg, E-Trade's Chief Executive Officer, Matt Audette, our Chief Financial Officer, and other members of E-Trade's management team. Before turning the call over to Steve, I'd like to remind everyone that during this conference call, the company will be sharing with you certain projections or other forward-looking statements regarding future events or its future performance. E-Trade Financial cautions you that certain factors, including risks and uncertainties, referred to in the 10-Ks, 10-Qs, and other documents E-Trade files with the Securities and Exchange Commission, could cause the company's actual results to differ materially from those indicated by its projections or forward-looking statements. This call will present information as of October 19, 2011. Please note that E-Trade Financial disclaims any duty to update any forward-looking statements made in the presentation. During this call, E-Trade Financial may also discuss some non-GAAP financial measures in talking about its performance. These measures will be reconciled to GAAP either during the course of this call or in the company's press release, which can be found on its website at investor.etrade.com. This call is being recorded, and a replay of this call will be available via phone and webcast beginning this evening at approximately 7 p.m. The call is being webcast live at investor.etrade.com. No other recordings or copies of this call are authorized or may be relied upon. And with that, I will turn the call over to Steve Freiberg.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining today's call. I will begin by covering highlights from the third quarter, and then Matt will take you through the results. I will follow with a few additional comments, after which we will open up the call for questions. We are pleased with our third quarter performance as we executed well during a period of extreme market volatility driven by continued uncertainty in the global economy. We reported net income of $71 million, or 24 cents per share, on revenue of $507 million. Our results this quarter included a tax benefit as well as two specific expenses that I will summarize up front, and Matt will provide additional details later in the call. First, we recorded an income tax benefit of approximately $62 million, or 21 cents per share, related to the taxable liquidation of a European subsidiary in conjunction with our international restructuring. On the expense side, we reserved $55 million, or 13 cents per share, related to our intention to initiate an offer to purchase auction-rate securities held by customers of E-Trade Securities. While we played a limited role in the market for these securities, we believe an offer to purchase is the appropriate thing to do for our customers and in the best interest of our stakeholders. And we will be pleased to put this matter behind us. Also on the expense side, our quarterly FDIC expenses increased $12 million from the prior quarter, including $6 million related to second quarter premiums. The FDIC made changes to its assessment methodology effective in the second quarter, and when the calculation of our new FDIC assessment was finalized in the third quarter, it resulted in a $6 million increase to the second quarter estimate. So, while we had a tax benefit and two expenses that were unique to the period, it was a solid quarter as we continued to execute on our strategic plan and focus on creating franchise value. The retail investor was highly engaged during this quarter, and we are proud that our team and our technology supported our customers through very volatile markets, and we successfully managed periods that included record trade, call, online chat, and login volumes. In fact, we were recognized by Smart Money on two occasions for having the fastest customer service response times, and by website monitoring firm Gomez.com for being among the brokers with the fastest online trades on days of extreme volatility. On August 8th specifically, and on the heels of the U.S. debt downgrade, we processed 359,000 trades, a company record. Investors also increased their engagement via mobile devices, and we saw record mobile transactions, more than 16,000 on that same day. During this busy quarter, we continue to execute on our strategic plan by adding sales resources, expanding our product offering, emphasizing our corporate services solutions, and managing our legacy loan portfolio. We are well on our way to increasing significantly our team of financial consultants and have grown this group by 33% year-to-date. This team is delivering quality accounts as evidenced by year-to-date asset growth of $8 billion, and we are very pleased with our momentum in this area. For our most sophisticated customers, we introduced Pro Elite, an exclusive program that combines no-fee access to our premier customizable trading platform, E-Trade Pro, with competitive pricing and priority service and support. We supported the launch with new television, print, and online advertisements and believe the program positions E-Trade as the best choice for the active trader. On the product front, we launched portfolio margin accounts, providing sophisticated traders with more flexibility to manage risk and leverage capital. We also added a number of enhancements to E-Trade Pro, and customers can now access a number of new features, including the ability to trade all option strategies, expanded CNBC content, logarithmic charts, cloud-based layouts, and the E-Trade community. Our corporate services group received a top rating in overall satisfaction and loyalty among stock plan administrators for the third year in a row, as reported by Group 5, a third-party corporate services research firm. In addition, we have now successfully deployed more than 200 clients on Equity Edge Online, our industry-leading equity compensation platform that launched in 2010. And with regard to our loan portfolio, we continue to decrease our credit costs, and delinquency trends continue to improve, including a 5% sequential decline in at-risk delinquencies. There is little doubt that the global economy will continue to present uncertainty. Regardless, we feel very good about our value propositions to both retail investors and institutional clients. We are pleased with the trends in our loan portfolio and the overall strengthening financial position. We remain optimistic about the opportunity to profitably grow our franchise. I will now turn the call over to Matt to take you through the numbers.
Thank you, Steve. During the quarter, we recorded net income of $71 million, or 24 cents per share, compared with net income of $47 million, or 16 cents per share, in the prior quarter, and net income of $8 million, or 3 cents per share, in the third quarter of 2010. As Steve highlighted, our income tax provision this quarter included a benefit of approximately $62 million related to the taxable liquidation of a European subsidiary. The subsidiary was liquidated in connection with the company's international restructuring activities. This liquidation resulted in the taxable recognition of certain losses, including historical acquisition premiums the company incurred internationally. This tax benefit resulted in a corresponding increase to our deferred tax asset, which currently stands at $1.5 billion. In addition, it's important to note that approximately one-third of the deferred tax asset is on the parent company's balance sheet and is a potential source of corporate cash in future periods. We generated $507 million in net revenue in the third quarter. This compares with net revenue of $518 million in the second quarter and an increase from $489 million in the same quarter of 2010. Our third quarter revenue included net interest income of $306 million, a decline of $10 million from last quarter. This reflected a net interest spread of 2.81% on average interest earning assets of $42.7 billion, down slightly from the second quarter spread of 2.89% on $42.9 billion in assets. Previously, we have discussed that with our current balance sheet strategy, we expect to produce a net interest spread of approximately 300 basis points in a normalized interest rate environment, and we still believe this to be true. However, if the current rate environment of extraordinarily low interest rates persists, we would expect meaningful spread compression in future periods. More specifically, we estimate our net interest spread could decline over time to approximately 250 basis points. I think it's important to note that this is not a forecast in any way, but rather a sensitivity analysis of the range of spread we believe our balance sheet would experience in the current interest rate environment and a more normalized interest rate environment. I would also highlight this assumes no change in our current balance sheet strategy, which may also change over time. Commissions, fees and service charges, principal transactions, and other revenue in the third quarter were $181 million, up from $174 million in the second quarter, and a 20% increase over results from the same quarter of 2010. This increase was driven by an 11% sequential and 30% year-over-year increase in DARTs. The increase was offset partially by a sequential decline in average commission per trade from $11.14 to $10.76, driven by customer mix, specifically a lower mix of trades from stock plan customers related to market performance and volatility during the quarter. Revenue this quarter also included $21 million of net gains on loans and securities, including net impairment of $3 million. Expenses, which increased by $51 million from the prior quarter, included a seasonal decline in advertising, the reserve related to auction rate securities, and an increase in FDIC premiums. As Steve mentioned, we reserved $55 million related to auction rate securities claims. This reserve relates to an agreement in principle between E-Trade Securities and the Securities Commissioner of the State of Colorado and the North American Securities Administrators Association to settle our outstanding auction rate securities claims. In connection with the settlement, E-Trade Securities has agreed to offer to purchase auction rate securities purchased through the firm by individual investors before February 11, 2008, and to pay a penalty and certain litigation investigative costs. The amount of the reserve relates primarily to our estimate of the securities' current fair value relative to their par value and includes other estimated settlement costs. We believe this offer to purchase is the appropriate thing to do for our customers and is in the best interest of our customers and stakeholders. As it relates to FDIC insurance, premiums increased $12 million from the prior quarter, including approximately $6 million related to the second quarter of 2011. As you may recall, the FDIC made changes to its assessment methodology effective in the second quarter. When our new FDIC assessment calculation was finalized in the third quarter, it was $6 million higher than our second quarter estimate. Going forward, the quarterly run rate will include this higher cost. We believe it's also important to note that the new assessment methodology is an asset-based system with risk adjustments based on the size and quality of the balance sheet. So as we continue to de-risk our balance sheet, decrease our credit costs, and improve our regulatory capital ratios, we would expect our FDIC costs to decline over time. Turning now to the metrics. DARTs for the third quarter were 165,000, an 11% increase over last quarter and up 30% from a year ago. During the third quarter, net new brokerage accounts were 13,000, down from 25,000 in the prior quarter and up from 7,000 in the third quarter of 2010. Year-to-date, net new brokerage accounts were 89,000, comparing quite favorably to 27,000 for the same period in 2010. Net new brokerage assets for the quarter were $2.6 billion. Through the end of September, year-to-date brokerage asset inflows totaled $8 billion, compared with $5.7 billion acquired during the first three quarters of 2010. We ended the quarter with $26.1 billion in brokerage-related cash, a decrease of $200 million during the quarter, and up $3.5 billion, or 15%, compared with the brokerage cash balance on September 30, 2010. Customers were net buyers of $2.2 billion of securities during the quarter. Average margin receivables declined by 5% sequentially, from $5.7 billion to $5.4 billion, and were up 15% over the same period in 2010. We continue to be pleased with the performance of our legacy loan portfolio and with the success of our loss mitigation activities. The portfolio contracted by approximately $700 million during the quarter. We reported a meaningful decline in net charge-offs, and delinquency trends continue to be favorable. Our loan loss provision was $98 million, down 5% from $103 million in the second quarter, and down 35% from $152 million in the third quarter of 2010. We expect favorable trends to continue over the long term, although they are subject to volatility in any given quarter. Loan charge-offs declined by approximately $21 million in the third quarter to $157 million, and were down from the $222 million we reported in the third quarter of 2010. The allowance for loan losses at quarter end was approximately $800 million. The performance of our legacy loan portfolio continues to benefit from aggressive loss mitigation strategies, including the use of servicers that specialize in troubled assets. As we discussed in our second quarter conference call, we transferred $1.4 billion in loans to such servicers in the month of July. These special servicers focus on loan modifications, often pursuing trial modifications for loans that are more than 180 days delinquent. The large transfer of loans during the quarter, combined with this focus on late-stage delinquencies, resulted in an increase in TDR delinquencies for loans 180 days or more past due during the quarter. After the successful completion of the trial period, typically 90 days, the loan will become current. There's no impact on the allowance for these modified loans as they had already been written down to the expected recovery value when they became 180 days past due. Overall, we continue to be pleased with the performance of our modified loan portfolio. Specifically, we saw an improvement in the average re-delinquency rates 12 months after modification for both 1 to 4 family loans, which was down to 28% versus 31% in the second quarter, and home equity loans, which was down to 42% versus 43% in the prior quarter. Moving now to capital. The bank generated $147 million of regulatory risk-based capital and $76 million of Tier 1 capital in the third quarter. As of September 30th, E-Trade Bank's Tier 1 capital ratio was 8.1%, and its risk-based capital ratio was 17.2%. With respect to our parent capital ratios, all of our required ratios were above the well-capitalized minimums. In addition, our consolidated Tier 1 common ratio was 9.3%. We also continue to track our consolidated ratios under Basel III requirements. We believe that Basel III in its current form will increase this ratio by approximately 20 basis points to 9.5%, meaning we estimate we are above the 2019 fully phased-in requirements today. The main reason for the increase in the Tier 1 common ratio under Basel III is the difference in capital treatment of unrealized gains and losses on available-for-sale securities. Turning now to dividends of excess capital out of our bank. Since late 2009, the company has requested and received the approval of our primary regulator to send quarterly dividends from our bank to our parent. The dividend had been equal to E-Trade Securities, our introducing broker-dealer, profits from the previous quarter. We believe our former regulator, the OTS, viewed these dividend requests as distinct from a more comprehensive request to release a portion of the bank's excess capital. During the quarter, we transitioned regulators from the OTS to the OCC and the Fed. We believe our new regulators would view all dividend requests with an equal level of scrutiny. Therefore, rather than pursue a request solely for E-Trade Securities profits during the quarter, we believe the best path for our shareholders is to work on a comprehensive dividend plan that could efficiently distribute capital amongst our regulated entities and parent company. We have begun this process, and our expectation is that it could take several quarters to conduct, and we cannot predict the likelihood or timing of regulatory approval for any such dividends. Moving now to corporate cash, we ended the quarter with $438 million, compared with $424 million at the end of the second quarter. To summarize, we are pleased with our quarterly and year-to-date performance, and although we are most certainly not immune to the challenges of the macro environment, we are confident that our strategy, supported by declining credit costs and an increasingly strong financial position, provides us the flexibility to execute through uncertain times. With that, I will turn the call back to Steve for closing remarks.
Thank you, Matt. Before taking questions, I would like to share a few additional comments. We are very pleased with the quarterly and year-to-date performance as we continue to execute on the plan we laid out 1 year ago on this same call. Customer metrics are strong, and our corporate businesses continue to gain momentum, while our credit outlook and capital position continue to improve each quarter. We have shown meaningful progress this year in a number of key measures, including new accounts, asset flows, and earnings. Comparing year-to-date results with the same period in 2010, we have added more than three times the number of net new brokerage accounts. Brokerage inflows are up 40%. We have generated $163 million in net income compared with a $4 million loss through the third quarter of 2010. Looking ahead, as evidenced by the increased activity in August, it is not possible to predict the markets or how the retail investors might engage in the short term. As it relates to October, month-to-date DARTs are flat compared with September. Regardless of short-term volatility, though, we are optimistic that E-Trade is well-positioned to meet the needs of both traders and investors today and over the long term. We continue to focus on initiatives that support our mission to deliver the best investing experience and plan over the next few quarters to introduce a number of enhancements to the customer and prospect experience. Later this month, we will introduce enhancements for option traders, including advanced screener, analyzer, and optimizer tools, followed by other new products for traders early next year. We continue to add customers to the beta version of E-Trade 360, our new personalized investing experience that allows customers to access all accounts and their favorite features on a single page. It will be differentiated in that the platform will be available to all customers, from the beginner investor to the most sophisticated traders. We expect to make E-Trade 360 available to all customers in mid-December and launch officially with additional features in early 2012. Also in December, we plan to launch a new prospect website, introducing an enhanced visual and navigational experience that we believe will increase prospect engagement and conversion. We should transition to this new site entirely by the end of January. We will continue to add sales resources in both our retail and corporate sales teams as we build on our momentum and focus on asset and high-quality account growth. Finally, During the quarter, we engaged Goldman Sachs to conduct a strategic review of our business to ensure we are maximizing value for all shareholders. While the committee and the board are making good progress, at this point, there is no additional information to share, so I will not have anything more to add this evening. Again, we are pleased with our third quarter performance and look forward to building on our progress as we close out the year and move into 2012. With that, operator, we are ready to take questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, in order to ask a question, please press star 1. Your first question comes from the line of Daniel Harris of Goldman Sachs.
Thanks, guys. Good afternoon. Appreciate the color you guys gave around the NIM and where you expected that could go to. I was wondering if you could put just a little bit more timing around that. You know, if things stayed the same and we do get to the 250 basis points, is that over 4, 6 quarters? How long would you think that would take? And what are your assumptions built into that for margin loan deterioration, if at all?
Hey, Dan, this is Matt. So as far as the balance sheet strategy that would ultimately lead to 250 in this interest rate environment, it's the strategy we're executing now. So it's focusing on a balance sheet funded by customer deposits. Our expectation is that that customer base grows, that margin loans grow along with that, and the legacy loan portfolio continues to run off, and the investment strategy is in little to no interest rate and credit risk assets. Specific on when we would hit that 250, there's no particular time frame on that. Other than if this current interest rate environment persists, that is our expectation of where it could go down to. It's not years, and it's not tomorrow. So it's probably the best way I could put it for you.
Okay, no, that's perfect. Thanks very much. Staying on the balance sheet, looks like, pretty much for the last year, we've been right around 42, edging up to $43 billion on the balance sheet. And I think that's where, Steve, you had said that that's a position you feel is comfortable. Any update on that? Do you anticipate, with the amount of deposits that are out there that would like to find a home, that could grow, or are you comfortable at that $41, $42 billion mark?
Yeah, then I think in several conversations on the topic, really did indicate that we don't have a precise number that we target, that the balance sheet ultimately will be driven, meaning its size, by the quality and size of the deposit base that's generated by our E-Trade customers. So we would expect it to grow with the passage of time, but in line with the needs of our customer base. It's been relatively stable for a while. There's clearly some volatility as customers have held more or less cash, depending upon the environment. But I think sort of a normal view would be if we grow our customer base 5-6% a year, that the balance sheet probably grows in line with that. Although I would say there's opportunity with the passage of time to diminish the use, because there's still a sizable amount of wholesale funding that's on the balance sheet that's both high cost and non-strategic. There's limits on how low it can go. But that said, I think, again, the balance sheet will be driven by the franchise side and size and the franchise needs.
Okay, great. No, that's very helpful. Just last for me and a different topic here, on the market-making side, I was a little surprised to see the equity shares traded drop by, close to 40%, yet your revenue capture was up by almost double. You know, what are you seeing there that drove that change, and what should we expect going forward? Thanks a lot.
Hi, it's Mike Curcio. Great question. Basically, it's a mix issue. So we saw much more trading in NMS issues, which are more profitable, and less trading in the bulletin boards. And we're seeing on the retail side, a lot of traders are seeing better opportunities in NMS these days. So that's what attributed that mix change.
So it wasn't a strategic shift. Essentially, it was basically the markets really selecting where they wanted to focus or concentrate. So that's going to move around. But clearly to Mike's point, the revenue per share is clearly more compelling in the mix, even though the volumes have come down substantially, although we can't predict that could shift around in any given month.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
All right, Dan. Thanks.
Your next question comes from Patrick O'Shaughnessy of Raymond James.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Hi, Pat.
First question I wanted to ask you, touching on the interest spread again, what is it structurally about your balance sheet that might protect it maybe more so than some other online brokers out there. And by that I mean, you know, if you look at some of the other online brokers that have net interest margins below 2%, you guys obviously kind of see yourselves normalized at 3% in this environment, maybe down to 2.5%. What is it structurally that maybe keeps your net interest spread maybe a little bit higher than some of the other online brokers out there?
Hey, Patrick, it's Matt. I think that just talking specifically to our customer base, when you think about a balance sheet funded almost entirely by your own customer deposits and non-maturity deposits, the spread that you can achieve on that is as unique to the firm as it is your customer base, meaning it's driven by the stickiness and the customer behavior of that cash. So focusing specifically on us, we think the sweep deposits are not a rate product. They're a product of convenience, and they are extremely sticky, and we think that is one of the biggest drivers that ultimately leads it to 300 basis points. But every firm is different, so our customer base, we think, is in the cash associated with it is the big driver of that.
Yeah, and I think you've seen, Pat, the shift over the last probably 12 to 18 months. More and more of our customer cash is in our sweep product, to Matt's point. Less is in a savings-oriented product where the customer specifically was oriented towards rate, and that shift has been quite substantial. So with low-rate sensitivity deposits that tend to have longer duration, we probably have a better opportunity to take advantage of the curve. That said, and we've emphasized this and we know, and it's systemic, our preference is to have a steep curve and one that's elevated in absolute terms from where it is. But in the absence of that, and to Matt's point, we think the range that we've laid out is a reasonable view, although it could go higher and or lower than that range. But we would say that range captures the vast majority of the scenarios that we think are likely, although clearly it's not definitive by its very nature.
Okay, fair enough. Appreciate the clarity there. And then as a follow-up question, when we look at your the deposits in the bank this past quarter, it was actually down slightly quarter over quarter. Is that just kind of a function of your customers were net buyers during the period and they moved some money from cash into securities? Or
Actually, you picked up exactly. Our customers, surprisingly, were very strong net buyers during the quarter. I recall the number being approximately 2 billion net?
2.2
billion. And so if you think about it, I believe our deposits were down I think approximately $200 million.
Yeah, so Patrick, if you're looking at the brokerage-related cash, it's down from 26.3 to 26.1.
Yeah, so the brokerage cash was down minimally, yet our customers were substantial buyers of securities during the period. So, you know, net-net, they absorbed a small piece of the cash they held with us, but really brought new resources to the firm in order to execute their transactions.
Okay, great. Appreciate the clarity. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Rich Repetto of Sandler O'Neill.
Yeah, good evening, Steve, and good evening, Matt.
Hey, Rich.
I guess the first question is, Matt, you explained sort of the TDR in the 180-day delinquencies. I'm sorry, but I wasn't able to catch the full explanation there. But the rationale or the driver behind the uptick in the delinquencies on the TDRs, the 180 days?
Sure, Rich. I think historically our modification programs have been focused on delinquent loans. In connection with the servicing transfer this quarter, we've started to focus on trial modifications, and the trial modifications are focused almost entirely on loans that are 180 days delinquent. So your typical modification, you agree to terms with the borrower, they make a payment, you make them current, and they go along their way. On the trial modifications, they're typically loans that are in the process of foreclosure. So we typically require that they make three payments in a row, because if we officially agree to modification, you would stop the foreclosure process. And then if they miss their second payment, you got to start it up again. So it gets very costly to do that. So we wait for three payments to occur and then make it current. So what you're seeing in that 180 days delinquent bucket is during that trial period, we continue to report them in that 180 days. But once they make that third payment, we'll move it current. The other thing probably important to highlight, Rich, is these are loans that are in the process of foreclosure, so they've already been written down to their estimated recovery value. So we think anything that we do here, there's only upside. Worst case, it doesn't work, and the costs are just the same as we previously thought they were.
Got it. That's helpful. And next, just on the revenue side, just a couple of small line items here. but the gain on sale of securities, you know, went down sequentially $6 or $7 million, as well as fees and services. And I know you've given guidance that it would go down, but you know, is this sort of the more appropriate run rate for going forward for both these lines, or any color you can give us?
So the answer, short answer to the question, Rich, is yes. On the gain on sale side, I think, you know, going back to 2009 and 10, that on an annualized basis, those bounced around the $150 million range. Back when rates were a lot more volatile than they've been this year, although the past couple months they're a little bit volatile. But our expectation is that gain on sale line, when compared to the $150 million range per year, is certainly going to come down. Specific to fees and service charges, we had a little bit of lumpiness last quarter with some corporate action, specifically the Citi reverse stock split that created some lumpiness in the fees. So we saw that come down to a more normalized level this quarter.
Got it. Okay. And then lastly, Steve, I will respect the guidance sort of you put it in the prepared remarks about the strategic review, but I will ask a question. When it does come to conclusion, or when you get to the findings that they ultimately get, come to, will there be a, I'm just trying to find, is there a conclusion to this? Is there going to be, you know, will you discuss this on a conference call later, or how do we expect to end this?
Rich, good question. Clearly there will be a conclusion. For obvious reasons. How we would convey that externally, I don't have a definitive view yet to provide you, although expectations, since we publicly said we've engaged and initiated, we will need a process to bring it to closure, both internally and externally. So when we're ready, I'm sure you will be on the invited list as someone who has, you know, tracked the firm and been important to sort of the firm over its years. But at this point in time, it's just something I can't give you precision on. Although, as you might expect, as much as you want to hear the conclusion, we would like to bring the process to closure and move forward. So stay tuned, but I just can't give you a precise answer yet. Although, since it is a public process, so to speak, at least as initiated, we will bring it to a level of closure.
Understood. Thank you for the answer very much.
And Rich, appreciate your respecting the process.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Your next question comes from Howard Chen of Credit Suisse.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Howard.
Back on the investment side, just curious what type of securities you're investing in today, what duration those are, and maybe what types of yields you're getting.
Yeah, so there's been no change in strategy there. So it's low interest rate risk, low credit risk assets, which essentially means agency securities. And our philosophy is really to match the duration of the deposits. So that's typically been in the 2.5 to 3 year range, and that continues to be the focus on the asset side.
Right. So, again, the duration runs in that 2.5 to 3, but the instruments will cover a very broad part of the curve.
Sure, great. Thanks. And then on your commentary of the increase in DTA at the parent company, just under what conditions would lead to a release of that, or something that, you know, you can use to invest in the business or deploy, et cetera?
It's pretty simple. It's income. So over time, as we earn income, we won't have to pay taxes on that income, and that will release the DTA. So of that $1.5 billion, $1 billion is essentially in the bank structure, and $500 million is at the parent. So ultimately, that will turn into cash through the avoidance of paying taxes.
Okay, thanks. That's helpful, Matt. And then finally for me, just on your commentary on the comprehensive plan, I know we have a few quarters here, but could you just help frame the parameters of the discussion of how you think about, you know, the excess capital and deploying that in this new context of a broader, more comprehensive plan?
Sure. So if you look at the bank, we have, you know, broadly $3.5 billion of capital. And if you look at all the different measures, anywhere from $1.3 billion of that to $1.5 billion of that is considered excess, at least on the official guidelines. So from our perspective, given we have $1.5 billion of debt at the parent, we would like to have the flexibility to efficiently manage that for the best interest of our shareholders. So you can expect that is the type of dialogue we would have. From a regulatory perspective, you can expect that they have certain other perspectives as well. So we're going to work through that. So we expect it to take several quarters to do so. So I would highlight that we're fairly comfortable going through that time period, given the level of corporate cash we have, which is, you know, slightly in excess of $430 million, and given that we just refinanced our nearest maturity over the summer. So our nearest maturity is now not until 2015. So we have well in excess of 2 years of debt service coverage, which is about $175 million a year. So we feel like we've got a decent runway here to work through this comprehensive plan.
Maybe just a follow-up to that, Matt, so just to confirm in very simple terms for me, so if you think you have $1 to $1.5 billion that you could upstream in the bank, you think you would like to use that to de-lever at the parent, and so you kind of view the size of de-levering with the excess capital that you have in bank as kind of one for one.
So we'd certainly like to upstream it to the parent. I think the 1.3 to 1.5 is the excess above the regulatory minimums. So I think everybody could expect in this environment for quite some time your regulators wouldn't allow you to dividend all of that up. But that's just the, you know, just to frame the discussion, that's where we'd be focused is on that excess capital.
Yeah, I think just to add, Howard, that I think the flexibility will be available to us with the passage of time, although we can't predict with any certainty time. What really happens, which is the continuation of the trend that we've been on for a while, which is improve the risk profile of the company, improve the earnings and the quality of the earnings of the company, and improve the capital position of both the bank and the parent. And as long as we continue down that path, I think it'll accrue to us many more degrees of freedom. And that's what we basically aim to work towards. And from your question on how we deploy it, I think, again, it's in part it's obvious that we are carrying a very heavy burden of the past, sort of the tax from the credit crisis, the loan, or basically the debt service being one of the burdens that we'd like to correct for. And I think Matt summed it up well. But there are other areas that we would invest in the company with the passage of time, but probably not prepared today to go into any detail. That one's the most direct and most obvious.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. That's helpful.
Your next question comes from Michael Carrier of Deutsche Bank.
Thanks, guys. Hey, just one more question on the capital side. It seems if you give the Basel III, you know, Tier 1 common, if you're above 9%, you know, at this point, I think that would be, you know, the only firm, you know, out there. So it seems like, you know, from a capital standpoint, you know, you'd be fine. But even, you know, when you think about going forward, because whether it's the capital that you have today or the capital that you're going to generate, you know, over the next, you know, 6 to 18 months, you know, we can calculate that. But where do you think, you know, you would be comfortable, you know, in terms of keeping that ratio and then based on, you know, what your conversations are with the regulators?
So the 9.3%, Michael's at the parent, I think we're focused on the bank. So the tier one leverage ratio at the parent's at 8.1%, and the risk-based capital ratio is at 17.2%. So depending on, you know, where the regulators focus, those would be the two ratios that would be most relevant to how much we could upstream. And the dollars in excess of those two, that's that $1.3 to $1.5 billion I referenced. So it's an area to have the dialogue. What they would ultimately be comfortable with of us upstreaming versus what we would desire, I think that'll play out over time. I think our objective, though, is just to have the most efficient distribution of capital between the bank and the parent in the future.
Yeah, and again, I think it's just worth emphasizing that if the regulators would speak, and this is obvious that it's not unique to our firm, just what I said earlier, this is not a binary item. It's essentially it will change with the passage of time, again, on what is the risk profile of the company, what is the capital position, which is the point you made, of the company, and what is essentially the earnings of the company, which clearly is future capital. So I think as we look at it, it's dynamic. It basically will change with the passage of time, and we also know the environment will change with the passage of time, maybe better, maybe not so much better, as the regulators assess what they believe is necessary for the safety and soundness of any institution, including our own. And I'm not trying. We're not trying to be avoid anything direct. Just to say that we know what we need to do with the passage of time to put ourselves in a better position, so we can gain more flexibility. But it is a moving target. It is dynamic. But it is important because that flexibility over time is important for us to have essentially a world-class franchise.
Got it. That's helpful. And then just one follow-up on the expenses. I guess just two questions on that. Anything unusual, you know, obviously ex the reserve, got that in any of the line items. And I guess the only one that kind of stands out is the clearing and servicing. So not sure if, you know, the transfer of some of those, you know, loans had an impact. Typically seasonally, you know, this quarter you would expect that to be a little weaker, but given the volumes in the industry, you know, might think that it would be a little bit higher. So just, you know, anything unusual, you know, in that line item or overall on the expense side.
So the two main items are the auction rate securities reserve and the increased FDIC insurance premiums. On clearing and servicing, so that line does include a lot of the costs associated with the risk mitigation activities. So that can be pretty lumpy. You saw a little bit of an uptick in that in the second quarter and saw that come back down, you know, call it more normalized levels this quarter. So it's just the lumpiness associated with that activity.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Your next question comes from Chris Allen of Evercore.
Good afternoon, guys.
Afternoon.
Just going back to kind of Dan's questions, I think you guys have done a good job in terms of explaining the balance sheet strategy, but if you could walk through just some of the mechanics in terms of how the NIM, the spread would decline, is it more of a function of variable rate loans repricing, new assets coming on at lower spreads in the securities portfolio? If you could just give us some clarity around that, would be helpful.
Sure, Chris. This is Matt. So exactly what you just highlighted. So on the asset side, as the legacy loans pay down at higher rates, you've got the reinvestment at much lower rates today. We also, as Steve commented earlier, we do have a wholesale book that was that we raised back in 07 and 08, which are at much higher cost. Over time, that will run off, which will actually improve it. But I think the gating factor here is the interest rate environment. So a company that funds itself with customer deposits in an interest rate environment of extraordinarily low rates, just the amount of spread you earn on those deposits is just much lower. So that's going to manifest itself in a lower spread over time.
Got it. And then, I mean, just how much of the securities book is rolling over on a quarterly basis at this point?
The legacy assets, I think.
The loan portfolio came down $700 million during the quarter. The securities portfolio is not a runoff portfolio, so there's a lot of buying and selling as well as pay down activity in there. So it's not a clean metric to give you there, but on the loan portfolio it was about $700 million for the quarter.
Just put it in broad stroke, if the average duration is, let's say, a little less than 3 years, you can probably do your own back-of-the-envelope math as to what that would imply from the standpoint of what rolls and has to be reinvested in any given period.
Sure, we'll do that. And then just one other question. Any commentary in the decline in advertising spending? Obviously, we expected it to kind of come in from a seasonal perspective, but it seemed to be
You hit it on the head. It's exactly that. Summer months basically reflect seasonality, and you would expect the fourth quarter to rebound to its normal seasonality, which tends to be typically one of the better quarters all in all from the standpoint of being in the marketing business, and that probably cascades right back into the first quarter.
Got it. And any change in the thinking on spending and advertising given the environment right now?
I would say that other than on the margin where we basically ebb and flow, I think broadly our strategy is intact.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Your next question comes from Brian Bedell of ISI Group.
Hi, good afternoon, folks.
Hey, Brian.
Just a couple of follow-ups. Going back to the dividend strategy, you know, dividending the cash up from the bank. If you get to a point, let's say at the end of next year, when you have that first potential hit at the springing lien notes, and you haven't been approved to dividend cash up, is there enough, or will there potentially be enough cash with some of the DTA being able to be deployed in the corporate cash you have on the balance sheet plus what you're earning to still potentially retire the springing lien notes even without dividending the extra cash up from the bank?
So, Brian, so the December 2012 call date, certainly our focus. I think that there's a lot of different things that impact corporate cash. I think the key thing to focus on here is the current level of cash. It's just over $430 million. No maturities of debt until 2015. And yes, that DTA at the parent, that $500 million ultimately would become cash at the parent. But that all depends on earnings over that same period of time. So it certainly could be volatile, but it is a potential source.
Right, right. But do you actually need a dividend from the bank to actually try to retire the springing lien notes? I guess is it dependent upon your success with the comprehensive dividend plan?
Sure. I think the math ends up being pretty simple. There's a billion of those notes. They'd be callable at 112. So you're talking, you know, over $1 billion, and the current corporate cash is $400 million. So there definitely need to be a source if you were going to call those in their entirety.
At least some of it. Okay, great. And then I calculated your effective tax rate at about 40%. Is that correct, and is that a good ongoing run rate for a normalized tax rate?
Yeah, Brian, it's going to bounce around in the low 40s. The key distinction there, you know, making it above the actual federal rate of 35% as well as some state noise, is about a third of that interest on the spring and lien notes is not tax deductible. So at some point in the future when those aren't around, it would actually improve it. But in the short term, the low 40s is a good assumption.
Okay, great. And then
just a point. You may just want to remind folks that because of the DTA and the like, even though the rate's high, just remember we're not paying cash taxes.
Right.
Yep.
Yep. No, definitely. And just on the net interest margin, just on one area, the wholesale borrowing costs, in your assumption of a static rate environment, do those wholesale borrowing costs that you have right now change significantly over the next several quarters or a couple of years? In terms of the actual, the rate you're paying on them.
Yeah. So the wholesale borrowing book, it's going to take a long time to run off. Those were brought on board in 07 and 08 when liquidity was at a premium. So we've locked those up for a long period of time.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do at this point. And this is sort of, if you put it in perspective, at least the way I view it, sort of the legacy costs that we're still incurring. That's one of them, and you could do the math as to what wholesale is versus if we replace that with customer. You made the point on the high cost of our debt. We made a point during the prepared remarks that our FDIC insurance premiums now are high relative to what we expect. This is a relative comment, but it also translates to absolutes, that if the profile of the company improves, those costs will come down. And finally, with the passage of time, we're still carrying a very heavy burden on provisioning. That we expect will, over the course of time, also come down. So all those items sort of vector in the right direction, but they all require time.
Right. Yep. And it just on the actual rate on that wholesale borrowing, the yield that you're paying in your scenario, Matt, did you expect that rate to stay roughly around the same where it is in the third quarter, in that 250 scenario?
So the wholesale borrowing book is locked up both in balance and roughly in rate for that long period of time.
Okay.
So neither would really move much.
That answers it. Great. Thank you so much.
Your next question comes from Chris Harris of Wells Fargo.
Good evening, guys.
Good evening.
I want to come back to the net interest here. Assuming there is some degradation heading into next year, I'm just curious, you know, what kind of flexibility do you guys have on the expense side to maybe offset some of that decline in revenue, if any?
So, expenses are certainly going to be a focus, especially the more challenging the environment gets. I think any company, ourselves included, would certainly focus on expenses. But I think the gating factor on net interest spread and the ultimately that going to the bottom line is going to be the interest rate environment. So there's certainly some things you can do on the expense side, but the spread in this environment would continue to be challenging.
Okay, fair enough. And then with respect to your attrition, I know you guys have made a lot of improvements here. Attrition rates really come down a lot from kind of the peak levels, but you're still running at, you know, kind of double-digit percentages and kind of above your peers. And I'm just kind of curious as to really what's really driving the accounts moving out and, you know, what kind of initiatives can you guys put into place to try to drive that down further?
Yeah, I mean, just for perspective for the rest of the group, we went back 2 years, the attrition rate at E-Trade was approximately 15%. And the company, through a number of actions, has effectively brought it down to just about 10 to 10.5%. So we've made a lot of progress over that point of time, which is important. Part of the differential is that we believe, a stricter definition of what's an open active account versus maybe industry norms. So we basically, when accounts have few assets within, and I think we're using less than $25, We effectively account is closed, and we count it as an attrited account. We don't believe, in fact, we know for a fact the industry doesn't use that standard. So what we've experienced, particularly this year, when we had the market prior to the last 2 months take a substantial decrease in value, a number of accounts fell into that. So what you could argue, because we track this, as you'd expect, not only in the aggregate, which is important, but by segment on where our income is really derived from. And what I will tell you is the customers that really drive this franchise, the attrition rates are in the 2-3% range, and they are extraordinarily good and strong. It's on that margin where you're really trading off not only the definition but the quality of the account and what's the incremental cost to keep someone versus the incremental benefit. I can't tell you that we're going to drive the 10-8, even though we would like to. What we will say is that we'll spend what we need to spend in order to drive the attrition rate to a level that makes economic sense for the franchise. And I don't know if that helps you, but it probably gives you some color. We manage it by segment. We report in the aggregate, but we also have a definition that we think is a bit more firm than others that basically we compete with within the industry. So we feel good about the progress we made. We feel good about the segments. Would I like it to be lower? The answer is yes. It doesn't make economic sense for us to drive it lower. I can't tell you because it has to be done from the bottoms up, not the top down.
It does help, Steve. Thank you. And last question here for me real quick. It sounds like you've had some improvement in your redefault rates, I guess, over the last 12 months. Now that you guys got, some higher quality servicers in there for, a large portion of your portfolio, what are you expecting there? Are you expecting a continued decline in the redefault rate? Maybe you can kind of quantify that for us if possible.
Sure. So you're referring to the modified at 12 months redefault rate?
Correct.
Yeah, so I think the servicers are definitely going to have an impact, and you're going to see that impact over time. I wouldn't get too precise on the number other than to reiterate that on the 28% redelinquency rate on the 1-4s and the 42% on the home equity, we feel really good about those. And certainly they could go down from there, but I think at those levels we feel good now. So we think the program is done well, and we're going to continue to focus on that.
Yeah, I mean, it really is, more of a, I think it's a good story not only for E-Trade but for the customers that have gone through the modification program. We think there's economic benefit to the firm that's real and it's measurable, and at the same time, the individual gets to stay within their home and has the capacity to actually, or the liquidity or the cash flow to actually make payments. And we were pleasantly surprised not only with the absolute number but the trend. And when we look at external data, and there's not a lot around, we think it basically benchmarks extraordinarily well. And so we also have learned over time how to, I think, be better selective and provide a more tailored solution to the needs of that particular customer. But again, to Matt's point, we can't predict the 28 or the 29 or the 26, but directionally, we've gotten better just about every vintage. And in addition to that, I think the absolute number or the range that it's in now is quite compelling.
Thanks, guys.
Your next question comes from Joel Jeffrey of KBW.
Good evening, guys.
Evening.
I just had a quick question on the timing of the ARS charge. Was that in any way related to the switch in regulators and their interest in having this behind you guys before they started to allow you to return capital to shareholders?
The answer is no. It's been an issue that's been out there for quite a while. I would say the quarter in which we made the decision to move down this path was completely independent and just basically coincidental to a change in regulators. I just feel good as the CEO of the company that it's been an issue that's been out there for a while and that we've had an opportunity now to start the process to put it behind us. And that's important. Again, a lot of the legacy of the crisis, the more of that we can put behind us, the more we can focus on our competition and the franchise, and that's really where we should be putting our energy. So it was just purely coincidental that it happened within the same quarter.
Okay, and what was the maximum client exposure?
At its peak, the clients had just north of $800 million of ARS within their accounts. You got to go back probably three and a half years, and the number basically in the last reporting period was approximately 125. that would have been at the end of the second quarter. Clearly, it's lower today than it was then. But as you would expect, that residual, meaning what's left, is by definition less liquid and more challenged, and therefore the reserve is reflective of that.
Okay, great. And then just lastly, I mean, with the sort of the new Volcker rule proposals coming out, just wondering what your thoughts are on how that could impact your market making business. Would it just be heightened compliance costs or anything along those lines?
Yeah, there would be some incremental costs on both, you know, management, compliance, and other related, but not substantial. And you know, we have a very small prop desk, so to call, but you know, you wouldn't see it if you looked for it from the standpoint in our revenues or our income. In fact, the last data point I can recall, which is 2010, I think we generated about $300,000 of revenue off that activity, and that was off a $2.2 billion revenue base. So it's really not of consequence from the business model standpoint on prop trading, but on market making, we continue to basically support, very proud of the business, and whatever the incremental costs are, it will not change our business model.
Great. Thanks for taking my questions.
At this time, there are no further questions. I will now turn the floor back over to Mr. Stephen Freiberg for any closing remarks.
Okay. Thank you again for joining us tonight, and we look forward to speaking with you again next quarter, and good evening to everyone.
Thank you. This concludes your conference. You may now disconnect.